hello. Happy New Year to you. Fenella Kernebone with you on By Design. And yes, this is another piping hot summer edition of the show. And talking about the heat, today we go tropo, plus we sit on the roof and we relax. Indeed. Once again, Happy New Year to you. I hope you've been having a good holiday so far. Now, in a moment, why being able to hear the rain, really hear the rain, is worth designing into buildings. And on theme, we visit a family home that has shifted the outdoor space away from where you might normally find it, from the backyard to above their heads.
This is a model of densification of the suburbs that doesn't require developers and doesn't require loss of amenity to your neighbours. The original house at the front, where we bought the backyard from, is still remaining. So in terms of sustainability, this is a great example of how to keep building stock, keep the streetscape, keep the quality of the suburb intact.
And that is architect and green roof garden owner Emilio Fuscaldo. You'll be hearing more from him soon as we get our green on. But to begin, let's begin by meeting two men, two architects, who midway through last year picked up Australia's highest accolade, the Gold Medal for Architecture from the Australian Institute of Architects. Phil Harris and Adrian Wilkie started Tropo Architects in 1980 in Darwin, not long after much of the city had been destroyed following Cyclone Tracy. And since then, as the practice has expanded, they've continued to create architecture that is in sync with Australia's distinct and diverse environments, whether it's in the city or in remote areas, big or small budgets. So welcome to By Design.
Hi.
Yeah, hi, Fenella.
Great to have you on the show. And let's go back a bit to the beginning because, I mean, your work has long been about our connection to the environment, about climate and sustainability and an ecological way of thinking. So since those sort of early and I imagine pretty heady days in Darwin, what was happening at that time post-cyclone construction that really drove some of those early principles to emerge?
We arrived in Darwin at the time that the Darwin Reconstruction Commission was being wound up, and it really was the nature of what Darwin was looking like through what the Darwin Reconstruction Commission and others had delivered that created a huge debate in Darwin. We didn't start it, but we certainly joined in, and it was about people wondering about what this place was that had disappeared, the old Darwin they couldn't recognise anymore. And it wasn't just about what it looked like, but it was about what it was like to live there, to actually enjoy the place. And these buildings, these concrete bunkers, which you could drop an atomic bomb on almost and they'd still survive, really didn't provide that ability to sit in Darwin and enjoy, you know, having a beer under the veranda with a ceiling fan and laid back.
And so, therefore, that's where the word even for the architecture firm came from, you know, tropo, which, of course, we know that the words mean, you know, being affected by the heat or something like that. But for you, it was about getting to really know the place, to understand the environment and the people who you were designing for. Is that right, Phil?
Yeah, so Xavier Herbert coined the phrase, speaking of Darwin, in his book Capricornia, here nature looms larger than man, to bow down before the strength of the climate and the strength of the environment broadly, I think, is a thing that people need to do more, not just in Darwin, across the planet, really.
Can we talk about a few significant projects? And an early one that was in Darwin was, you called it the Green Can, or that was nicknamed the Green Can, and that was one that shows principles that still exist today in many of your structures, whether they're for a community or someone's house. And these are the idea that you can adjust the climate, that you are part of the environment. What was this responding to?
I think it's really interesting to look at where that building came from. It was part of a competition which Paul Everingham and others were promoting. He was the chief minister at the time in the territory, to provide not just affordable housing, he called it low-cost housing, which probably was a mistake, but affordable, achievable housing, but also to be tropical. And the argument was, and he put that out there, that if we don't provide housing for people to enjoy living in Darwin, to enjoy living in the tropics, then we won't ever maintain a stable population of people in Darwin. So the competition and our building, the Green Can, was really just looking back at the pre-cyclone buildings, the techniques that they used to provide really comfortable, passively cooled buildings, and interpreting that into a new building. It was certainly new but old. Phil uses the word, we were a radical traditionalist. We were using the old in a new way. And I think the success of that building was in the fact that people could recognise those mechanism, tools and materials, the whole thing that it exuded. It equally created created a huge reaction in those people that were pretty offended by the very thought that they might have to live in something like that, in inverted commas.
Yeah, so the Green Can had brought veranda boards inside, like down corridor spaces, living areas became breezeways effectively. It was single skin in its construction, so it gave up its heat most quickly at night, and therefore it had a lot of exposed framing, and people were worried about cobwebs in relation to that. And there were a lot of spaces where really there weren't walls or windows at all, but merely openings like up high at the ridge vent, etc. So it was a very spare construction and did invite great connection with the environment.
Mm. So you're basically retraining how people could live or were to live in Darwin that was responsive to the climate, that did allow us to, or those who were living there, to be in their space.
Yeah, and again, imagine that Cyclone Tracy wiped out just about the whole physical fabric of Darwin, so there's very little left. Well, there was certainly enough to explore, but people coming from south and with perhaps little experience of tropical regions elsewhere had very little to work with to understand what the possibilities were, what the potential was.
Another concept that I've loved reading about is this idea that, again, about allowing the environment in, but it's also the concept of hearing the rain, which sort of extends on from what we've been talking about, that bringing the outside in and the inside out. Why has that idea been a sort of a beautiful springboard for so many of your projects, whether it's in Darwin or elsewhere?
The sound is really important. It's just fantastic when it rains in Darwin, and it's just a moment to celebrate. I think rain anywhere around Australia, particularly in the centre, in the arid regions, people love to celebrate that. Why not be able to hear it? And similarly, it's just wonderful to hear the birds, you know, and the rustle of the leaves and in the trees. It's fantastic, much better than a painting on a wall. But, yeah, the play of water is just something we've really kind of enjoyed doing. When we did Boali with Glenn Murcutt, which is the visitor centre out in Kakadu National Park, it was a landscape interpretation centre, and we made great play of the water on the roof echoing a escarpment creek and the water tumbling to billabongs that had come centrally into the building space, and water would flow around the building in a way that integrated with movement around the building. So water accompanied your journey through the building, and we've used that, you know, in residences and other building projects as well. It's a great cooling thing, but it's just that wonderful sound of water, and seeing water in its journey from your roof to the ground can be kind of fun, you know?
It certainly can be.
It's interesting to note too that in living in Darwin and in our own houses, when we had guests from down south and these buildings were particularly minimal and thin, having possums landing on the roof, it wasn't just the rain, it was the banging and crashing of the wildlife through the whole of the night, that yep. Some people at least needed a bit of therapy by the time of the end of their visit because they hadn't slept a wink.
But can you come to my place and sort out the possum in my roof?
Oh, we have kind ways of doing that. But yeah, but it is that level of we've disengaged ourselves right across the country. Coming from a good farming background, listening to the rain on the roof was one of the pleasures of life. It was the turning of the seasons.
Why do we want to hide water in downpipes?
Yeah.
Oh, how demeaning.
Water should be out there. On By Design, I am speaking with Phil Harris and Adrian Welke. They are my guests, and they recently picked up Australia's highest accolade, the 2014 Gold Medal for Architecture from the Australian Institute of Architects. They are also the founders of Trupo Architects. Now, Phil, just before you mentioned the Boali Visitors Information Centre in Kakadu, the one that you worked with Glenn Murcutt, and there have been a number of really interesting projects that you've done, including an aged care facility in Pukacha, working with Indigenous communities, Aboriginal communities as well. Some of your proudest moments, you've described these projects in Trupo Architects. Why is that?
There's kind of two sides to this question. I'll start with maybe the more poetic side. We've been talking about really engagement with the environment. It's so wonderful in projects working with traditional owners to have them participate in the identifying of appropriate materials in a building and then winning those projects from the bush, from, you know, around the site, and playing with them, you know, like you play with them in the raw state and in a more polished state. So, you know, timber that's rough sawn or just one cut on it from the tree, and using the bark for that matter in the buildings as well, and then but using them more polished and door handles or found bush timber, but using rocks as reception desks and painting buildings with the bauxite mud of the site, as we did up in Weipa with a reconciliation project with three communities as well as Weipa Township. It's just great fun getting engaged, and having the parties at the end are quite fantastic. But often these building projects are about interpretation as well. So there might be formalised interpretive displays in the buildings where we work with people, and our mate David Lancashire has been a big part of that journey. So it's enriching, and you get to see the landscape through other people's, and importantly Aboriginal people's eyes. And obviously we only go a short distance down that. I wouldn't claim that we have developed an Aboriginal viewpoint yet, but we're proud to have at least seen that one exists and have that opportunity to perceive the landscape in these different ways. And Adrian spent so many years in the centre and beyond producing durable, tough buildings.
That is the other side of the work that we do, that it's involving Aboriginal health and housing. And in the particular example you mentioned at Pukaja, it's an aged care facility, a respite facility. And to mention that, that does include a lot of other people working in a team. It was Paul Follis working with Ngunnawal Health, and also Kirsty Bennett as an aged care specialist from Melbourne. But that's an extraordinary experience in a most beautiful corner of the country, to get together a project in what is a pretty tough part to deliver things, and that is by getting builders out there and getting them built, but also working with the aged care committee to understanding what does it mean to provide a respite facility for aged people spread across the APY lands, which is all of 700 kilometres wide by a couple of hundred kilometres deep.
And something that can grow organically with the community as it shifts as well.
That's right.
Phil and Adrian, just back to the award. Now, I wanted to read what the jury wrote. They said that Troppo is irreverent but sophisticated, inventive but with a tinge of larrikin spirit. Let's focus on the word irreverence, maybe, sort of going to work day after day and having obviously been doing this for quite some time now. Why is that important?
I guess you only get to live once, and we've had the joy of sharing our practice with about 100 people and watching a lot of people get up every day and do it again and work so hard at producing outcomes that people lose sleep over and want to make the best that can be. I just think it really, that's what humanity is about, and I think the architectural profession at large digs in way deeper than it gets paid for. So we just do what most architects do, I think, in that regard. And I guess we're just open and honest about it. We don't wear bow ties or have, Adrian and I have never had our own offices. It's everyone's in boots and all.
Gentlemen, absolutely fantastic, and thank you so much. It's great to talk with you. And again, congratulations for the gold medal. Thanks for joining me here on By Design.
Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers.
Phil Harris and Adrian Wilkie there from Troppo Architects, and you can check out the link on our website. You'll also see, if you do pop along and have a listen to that one again on a podcast, a collection of photographs of just some of the buildings that we were talking about. Beautiful, beautiful ideas, Troppo Architects. And a question for you, do you love rain on the roof? I do. Or maybe it drives you batty. I don't know. What do you listen for in a building? Feel free to get in touch with us on our website or on our Facebook page as well. Now, coming up in a moment, we give thanks. We give glorious thanks to the creation of the pen nib, simple design that allows some serious handwriting.
You're listening to By Design here on RN with Fenella Kernebone.
Well, a pen nib is certainly an essential tool. Whether it's a quill and pen or a fountain pen, it's enabled the writing of some great things, the signing of empire-changing treaties, the writing of great tomes, your weekly shopping list. In today's design file, Rajiv Surandra explains to Section D's Pauline Eicherman why he loves the nib.
We have three candles lit. We have this beautiful 1840s elaborate inkwell with two glass ink bottles. One of them is filled with brown ink. We have a little piece of cloth that's used for blotting the ink, and a wax seal, and then some great paper. There are many different factors that affect the finished product. The flexibility of the nib, the size of it, the metal, how old it is. This is actually an antique nib. It's an old vintage nib. There's an incision or a cut in the middle of the nib. And what that does is it allows the nib to split open when pressure is applied. So that property is what creates this beautiful writing. when I press down on the pen, when I'm making a downstroke, it makes the line wider. When I'm going up, the line is a single thin line, and that contrast of thick and thin lines is what makes this copper plate script so beautiful. That muscle memory takes years to achieve, so that when I throw or pull a stroke, so this is called throwing a stroke, when I make a stroke away from me, and this is pulling a stroke, those lines have to be fluid.
And so how did your interest in calligraphy start?
When I was 12 years old, an older friend had given me a pile of letters from the 1800s. So they were handwritten letters. And I think my older friend knew that I would like these. And I did. I was kind of fascinated with the letters. What drew me to them was the handwriting, the style of handwriting. All of the writing was very, very beautiful. I took those letters to elementary school, and we had to write in cursive for certain things, and I would copy some of the letter forms. And slowly, over the course of a few years, that style of handwriting became my handwriting. So when I was in high school and I was using a ballpoint pen, I would be writing that way. And then in university, I discovered the tools that they would have written those letters with originally: a bottle of ink, a metal nib, a pen holder. Then I picked them up, and when I started writing with them, it was very, very natural. I started using the calligraphy for very specific things. So if I was sending a letter to the CEO of a company, I would address the envelope with calligraphy, and it would always get to the person that it was addressed to. It usually bypassed the assistant. So I discovered that there was a power to this.
On By Design, that's Rajiv Sarandra, espousing the beauty of the pen, talking to Section D's Pauline Eichermann. This is By Design, and yes, you're listening to RN. By Design, Fenella Kernebone with you, and some beautiful sounds there. A little short snippet of a remix that Bibio did of an artist called Tycho and his track called Spectre. And now we head to our In the Field. Now, putting a garden on top of an office block or an apartment block, that's not so unusual anymore. But building a garden on top of the family home in the suburbs, well, that's not something that you hear about very often. But we're about to visit one such home in the Melbourne suburb of Coburg. So Jan Ryan went outside, but up top, with Emilio Fuscaldo, architect and green roof garden owner, to take a look.
Okay, so we're just climbing up the ladder now to get up to the roof. Well, we're up on the roof, so why did you build a green roof?
Okay, well, we didn't want to compromise on sustainability with this house, and we wanted to demonstrate that even on a small block and in the city, you can achieve big feats of sustainability without having to compromise the design, look or feel of your house.
Now, we're in the suburbs, I think.
That's right, we're in Coburg, and we're about 7 kilometres from the city. You can see the city just over there.
Yeah, I can see this kind of cityscape, and it feels very close. It's a fairly conventional suburb. There's regular houses around and everything.
This is an example of urban infill. This is a model of densification of the suburbs that doesn't require developers and doesn't require loss of amenity to your neighbours. This is a doubling of the number of people on this block, and no developers were involved. And the original house at the front, where we bought the backyard from, is still remaining. So in terms of sustainability, this is a great example of how to keep building stock, keep the streetscape, keep the quality of the suburb intact.
This section where your house is and the green roof was once the backyard for the wooden house in front.
Yeah, that's right. So they sold that at an auction. We bought it. This block was 600 square metres, 650 square metres, and we bought 180 square metres of that. It's north-facing and faces a laneway, so we've got nice amenity and access to the back. And our house is 80 square metres. The green roof component is 60 square metres.
The greenery we're standing on is grass.
This patch in the middle, which is yellow,
bit dry.
It's a bit dry. Summer grasses is grass. Then we've got five different types of succulents planted around the edges: chicken and head, and ladyfinger, lamb's ear, and they're all doing really well. It doesn't get watered up here. We did have an irrigation system. We don't turn it on anymore to save water. There's 200 millimetres of soil below our feet that goes down to the roof.
Now, I can see bees and things floating around there as well. So obviously there's an environment that's starting to grow and shared with the neighbours as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what green roofs do. There's a part of the green roof that allows for, I suppose, local and urban habitat to continue. It's a safe place for them, apart from the cats who visit up here.
Oh, do they? How do they get up here? They climb the ladder.
They jump on the water on the water tank and climb up here. But they're safe from dogs. It reduces the amount of stormwater runoff, which is quite crucial to local council. I mean, if you compare it with our neighbour who has paved their entire backyard, the amount of heat that's radiating off their paving into the environment's significant, but we're sort of absorbing a lot of that heat.
Up here and looking over the neighbour's development, which is quite substantial, they would have, I would assume, a loss of privacy. Did that issue come up at all about rooftops being a place where, you know, other houses lose the privacy of their back garden and so on?
We didn't envisage that this space is used as a private open space. So essentially, this is the same as any other roof, and we get up here to do maintenance. Of course, we're doing a lot more maintenance than our neighbours are doing on their roofs. They probably never get up there. But we're probably up here once every 6 weeks. And look, to be honest, no one's raised privacy as an issue. In fact, we sort of wave and have a joke. And, you know, that's not to say in the future with new neighbours it'll be different, but for now it seems fine.
Why don't you come up here more often? It's actually beautiful. It's a garden. It's got beautiful plants. We can hear crickets and things. The birds are around. It seems like a perfect retreat.
Yeah, especially because I've got two little boys and a dog and a cat. It's very nice to be up here on occasion away from everyone. The reason we don't come up here is simply because it's very busy for us, a busy lifestyle. But look, when we are up here, the benefits and the views and the cool breeze that comes in the afternoon, it's glorious. And it's nice. Coburg is a very built up and hard landscape. It's a lot of concrete, not many trees. So to be in a landlocked suburb like this and to have a bit of greenery and catch those breezes is beautiful.
The grass itself, what do you do here? Do you mow it, or you have a lamb up here or something?
Yeah,
you put
a little
animal up
here? It'd be nice to have one of those. No, just the whippersnipper around half an hour and it's done. So, and I only do that once or twice a year.
Ah, okay.
So that's why it's very yellow, because we don't... lawns you need to maintain. You need to crop them and you need to feed them. This lawn, we don't do that. It just comes and goes with the seasons.
Have you thought about growing wheat or something like that up here? Could you do that, do you think?
I'm not sure about... we haven't explored other options. We have grown vegetables up here. So we've had tomatoes and zucchini up here, and they did really well. But they require a lot of maintenance, and they're seasonal, so they'll die and come back. So we wanted an option where maintenance and gardening wasn't the priority. It was sort of a low-maintenance garden for us. In the future, hopefully that changes.
How does it work with a green roof with plants on the top? How do you keep the house dry?
If you think about the roof structure as a sandwich, basically, with lots of layers, there's a waterproofing layer, which is like wetsuit material. It's very strong and robust. On top of that is essentially a drain, which is a horizontal flat sheet drain they use actually under the MCG. So the water, as it comes through the soil, hits the drain and is whisked away down to the back of the roof and then collected by an eaves gutter and goes back into our water tank. So the drainage is very quick. As soon as it's raining, you can see water coming out of the back of the garden.
Have you noticed the effect with your bills, your electricity bills and so on? Has it kept the house cooler in summer and warmer in winter?
Yeah, I actually had an architecture student from Deakin University use this house as a case study for his thesis, master's thesis, and he pulled together all sorts of numbers for me. So what we found was in winter we have hydronic heating in the concrete slab. We've noticed a 27% reduction in the use of gas. Everything for us is gas. We only have a minimal amount of things on electricity, so you don't notice the electrical bills are cheap, but they'd be cheap anyway. The average temperature last year outside was about 32 degrees and inside it was 25. So there's that 6 to 7 degree temperature differential.
And as an architect, what are your clients asking you for? Are you advising them to do roofs like this, or what's been this sort of ongoing outcome of this?
It's been interesting. A lot of people get in touch and want to do it retrospectively on their existing houses, which is incredibly difficult to do. There's a few people who want to do it from at the outset, but what I'm finding is that people don't have the money. So conventional roof's about 10 grand, this cost us about 30. So it's about $20,000, which when people are struggling with their budgets, that's at $20,000 that they recoup very quickly. You've just got to find the right client who has the financial means and also the foresight, I suppose.
The readiness.
The readiness to do it, yeah.
Well, I think it might be starting to rain, so we've got to climb back down the ladder. Thanks, Amelia.
Thank you.
Architect Amelia Fuscaldo there speaking with By Design's Jan Ryan outside up top having a cup of tea. Don't forget to check out By Design's podcast. You can download it from our website or head along to iTunes and grab it from there. And why don't you do a little review and a rating while you're at it. But that's the program for today. Our producer is Jan Ryan. Joe Wallace is looking after the sound. And my name is Fenella. And do stay with us because Michael McKenzie is up now on RN with First Bite.